Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, not this again. Why does it keep doing it? Okay, at least we got it stopped early this time. This is Seth Kamen, SethandSean.com. SethandSean.com, Seth and Sean the radio show, backsportspage.com, hanging on Blog Talk Radio. I am trying to call to get Sean Palmer on the phone, or on air, and this isn't running correctly, which is a bit bothersome. I'm going to try again. We have a lot to talk about. We have Mike Pizeski, one of our best analysts, will be on to talk college football. And I really feel bad because I can't get Sean on air, which is a bit of an issue. Hopefully he'll try calling in again. We have an enormous amount to talk about. Let's see if we got it here. Hey, are you on?
I'm here.
Sorry about that. That one was my fault, ladies and gentlemen. For some reason, Blog Talk Radio decided they didn't want to hear Seth and Sean. They just wanted to hear Seth, which nobody ever really wants to hear.
But that's okay because today is basically the Seth show anyway.
No. First of all,
college football definitely not my forte.
I agreed, but it's not going to be a whole show of college football. We have Mike Pizeski coming on at 7:15. He's going to talk for 15 minutes. I'll add a couple minutes here and there. But there's so much happening. You know, we've gone through like a summer of really depressing stories, and then we had the Olympics, and then we've had a couple weeks of nothing. Oh, we don't have nothing anymore, do we?
We got a huge baseball trade.
Yeah, I was going to say you want to start with that. The gist of it. The GDP of a small country going west as the Los Angeles Yankees have acquired Adrian Gonzalez, Carl Crawford, Josh Beckett, John Hancock, Sam Adams, and another beer to be named later for James Loney and three or four prospects.
You know what, though? Don't sell short what the Red Sox did here.
I think what the Red Sox did was fantastic. I think unless the Dodgers win a World Series in the next 2 years, the Red Sox make out like bandits on this trade because they're not going to the playoffs this year anyway. This is not the 1978 reincarnation of the Yankees. They're not coming back from 12 back.
No, I think this trade does two things, and I think it does what both teams wanted to do. I think for the next 3 years, the Dodgers are set up to be a perennial powerhouse in the National League, assuming they re-sign Clayton Kershaw, which I don't think will be an issue considering the GMP of Congo was given out this year, or at least this week, to four players, one more on the payroll. But remember, the Dodgers have a lot going for them right now. They have the new ownership, the Guggenheim ownership led by Magic Johnson, and they really have to put a face on that franchise. I think they really did that with Adrian Gonzalez, with Carl Crawford, who I do think will rebound and be a productive player. And even more so, right now, the Dodgers have to compete with the Lakers. I mean, the Lakers just made their huge deal. If the Dodgers want to be relevant in that town, they needed to make a splash, and splash they did. As far as what the Red Sox did, all the credit in the world for being able to dump three contracts, basically only one of which the players that the Dodgers wanted. The Dodgers only really wanted Gonzalez. So they were able to tack on two additional contracts of $200 million in total, it was about $230 million, $240 million, and they got three prospects out of it. Pretty good prospects at that.
I agree. I thought the Redskins, you see where my mind is. The Redskins
have not done anything good in this decade. Continue.
No, they haven't. Well, they drafted RG3. That's about the extent of that. But I disagree with you on one point. I do think the Dodgers had a man of the franchise or whatever you want to call it in Matt Kemp. Now, the difference being with Adrian Gonzalez coming in, bringing in a Latino superstar may grow their Hispanic audience. I don't think they needed a name. I think they needed player. They were still on the precipice of being a playoff team of being a World Series caliber team if Josh Beckett can pretty much forget the last 18 months and move forward. And Carl Crawford, I mean, anything you get from Carl Crawford is just gravy anyway. But you have that middle of the lineup of Hanley Ramirez, Andre Ethier, Matt Kemp, and Adrian Gonzalez. That's about as good as anything you're going to see.
Well, two things. Do you understand that you just said that anything you get for $100 million over the next 6 years is gravy?
As pathetic as that sounds, am I wrong?
Well, you know, the thing is, I think Crawford is going to be a productive player in Los Angeles. I really do. I think he's going to revert back to the way that he was in Tampa Bay. I think that the way – I mean, let's look at what Carl Crawford is really good at. Carl Crawford is really good at running the bases. He's really good at playing defense in a big outfield. And he's really good at making contact and being able to run out hits. Now, let's see.
Sounds like a prototypical National League player.
Right. What is he not? He's not a prototypical AL East player that plays the bandbox of Fenway Park.
But he was an AL East player when he was this top five outfielder who earned this contract in Tampa.
Correct, but look where he played. He played in the Tropicana, which was on turf. It was a spacious outfield. He was Joe Maddon and Lou Piniella liked to run. When's the last time that a Red Sox player stole 40 bases in a season? I don't remember it. I don't think it was in my lifetime.
No, I think you're going back to the Johnny Pesky era.
Yeah, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, They don't run in Boston. And the left field, which is 230-some-odd feet from home plate, which is a 37-foot wall, is not really conducive to Carl Crawford and his strengths. He went – what they thought that they were going to be able to do was put Crawford in left field, and he'll be able to – bang it off that Fenway monster every time, but that's not conducive to what he does. And I really think putting him in Los Angeles, which has a spacious outfield, he's a speedster. He put him at the top of that lineup. He's 120 runs next year. If you put, like you said, that middle of that order is fantastic now. Yeah, do they have to win a Stanley Cup? Do they have to win a World Series in the next 3 years to justify this? I think they have to make one. I don't think they have to. I don't think they have to. They have to win one. I think they have to make.
Well, the nice part about being in LA is it will never be the main sport. So people are Laker fans first, foremost, in everything. It's not, you know, when you even in Boston, which has such a rich tradition. Whether the Boston is more of a Bruins fan, Bruins town, a Celtics fan town, or a Red Sox town, you would know you having lived there for a couple of years. But I still think of it as first and foremost a Red Sox town.
Yeah.
Am I right on that?
Yeah, you're definitely right on the back.
You know, New York, surprisingly enough, is a Yankees town. You know, L.A. is not. L.A. is a basketball town. Everything else is very secondary. That the Dodgers are good is going to bring in, you know, because the Los Angeles fans are not known are known for following teams when they're on their rise up. Let's put it that way. You're never going to see in the top five sports towns in America, Los Angeles is never going to be ranked. Let's go from there. So what are we thinking about with the prospects that Ben Cherington gets back from Boston? About this than I do, but
yeah, let's understand that first of all, any prospects that he got back was fantastic, because just being able to dump all that salary. And I'm not saying that these are bad players. I'm not saying that Adrian Gonzalez is a bad player. I'm not saying Carl Crawford is a bad player. And I'm not saying Josh Beckett is a bad player. I am saying that in the economics of baseball, they are bad contracts. And when you hamstring a budget the way that Boston did, the way that the Yankees do, and you get up in age, you're going to have problems. And that's what the Red Sox were doing. They were hamstringing their budget. Understand right now that next year, the Red Sox have about $42 million on their budget, on their payroll, which is about $100 million left. Now, the problem that Ben Cherington is going to have is that there are no free agents out there to do this with. I mean, it's nice to have that money and hold that money and use that money, but you need players to use that money on. And I don't see the free agency out there for them to use that money on. Now, as far as two big prospects that they got back, Ruby De La Rosa, who was just coming off of Tommy John surgery, pitched last year, can throw it in the high 90s, a good slider, good curveball, has the potential, according to Keith Law, who, as far as I'm concerned, is the expert on minor leagues, Keith Law of ESPN, he has the potential of a 2-3 starter, which is not bad. I mean, there are very few number ones out there. It's kind of like basketball where you have number ones. And then the second prospect, they got two great pitching prospects. Number two is Alan Webster, who is a single ball slider pitcher. Again, a 2-3, maybe a one, but probably a number two or a number three starter. And you put them, if they do, and remember, these are prospects. Prospects pan out one every three, one out of every four. So if both of them pan out, you can slot them in with Buchholz and Lester and have a very good rotation for about 5 or 6 years.
So who makes out the best when it's all said and I mean I think the teams that are I guess it looks like every team in the AL East and even in the NL West is really National League currently is hurt by this. The Giants are devastated by this because this makes the Dodgers the overwhelming favorite to run away with the division at this point, I believe. They're you know despite San Francisco's great pitching with Kane and Baumgartner Vogelsong, that's the Yankees can't be thrilled, and the Devil Rays can't be thrilled because yes, this year is probably a wash. But looking into 13 or more, even more into 14, 15, when there are bigger free agents out there, I think I can see a huge concern on that going there. Wow, I did not articulate that well at all. Ooh,
I think the big winners of this trade. I think the Rays are very happy. I think the AL East is very happy except for the Yankees right now for the next 2 to 3 seasons. I don't see the Red Sox being able to come back from this for 2 to 3 years, which inherently means to me that Bobby Valentine is going to return next year. Because as I said earlier on in the baseball season, and I said it on this show, Bobby Valentine is really good with the team to bring them up to a spot, to a young team to bring them up. He can't get them over the hill. And right now, he can't get them to that championship level. He can get them right below it. He's kind of like a Buck Showalter, right below it. But he can't get them above it. And I think that they're going to hold on to Bobby V for one more year and let him ride this out. I really think that the Orioles have to love this deal. Love it. Because they're coming on strong now. They got some young players. The Rays got to love it. Toronto has to love it. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the Red Sox were in last place next year, given the lack of talent that they have right now. As far as the National League, you're right. Nobody in the West loved this deal. Nobody. And I would think in the National League, nobody likes this for a couple of reasons. Number one, look at how much better the Dodgers just got. But number two, hey, guys, the Dodgers are back, and they're willing to spend. And while that's great for baseball to have the Dodgers as a healthy team, that is scary that they were able to take on $230 million at the blink of an eye and not really care about it.
Now, does this make them the favorite in your eyes in the National League?
No, I'm still going with the Reds. I'm still going with my team that I picked from the very beginning. I still think that they have, if they get home field advantage, that is a tremendous home field advantage. I want to see Beckett. Beckett got shelled last night in his first start for the Dodgers. As far as the lineup is concerned, yes, they have probably the best 3, 4, 5, 6 in the National League. But they don't have the best pitching staff. I still give that to, unfortunately, the Phillies, who are nowhere near contention, or the Reds, with Latos and Cueto.
It does lead to it's so fascinating because you don't see trades like this in the middle of the year. You don't see trades like this ever.
This has never happened. Never. the closest that this is, the closest that you could say this, something like this happened, was in the 70s when the A's were trying to sell off their players, such as Joe Rudy and Vida Blue and, who was the other guy? There were three guys that they tried to sell off. And Bowie Kuhn stepped in and said, no, sorry. You're not selling your players. But if you look at it, isn't that really what happened? I mean, they sold their players. This is a, for the Red Sox, this is a straight salary dump.
Yeah.
And if I'm the Dodgers, I don't even know why I gave up that much.
Well, changing sports here. I believe we are now going to be joined by Mike Pazeski, college football analyst for Back Sports Page. Mike, how you doing?
Not too bad, man. How are you?
Doing well. You stoked for a little bit of football talk?
It's been too long. We've been talking about too much that has gone on off the field. It's time to talk about some stuff that's actually going to happen on the field this weekend.
Well, I guess.
The first big game coming up, Alabama and Michigan, coming up this weekend. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's definitely the first real notable game between two top 10 opponents. You hear all the talk from experts, and they say that Michigan really has no chance. And I kind of beg to differ, because if there's any chance to get Alabama, it's going to be the first week of the season when they're breaking in a lot of young talent, a lot of talent that hasn't played on a big stage yet. It's on a neutral field. It's not in Alabama. And they have Denard Robinson. He's the ultimate X factor, and he's a Heisman candidate. He's a senior. He's got the experience. A lot of questions about Michigan's defensive line and, you know, how dominant Alabama's offensive line is. And that's really where the game is going to be won and lost. And I think because of that, you have to give the edge to Alabama. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion like everybody just assumes that it is. Everybody assumes that it's going to be like 41-3 or something like that. But I really see this as a close game. Michigan's speed really able to kind of dictate tempo a little bit. And don't be surprised if they jump ahead early and then take advantage of an inexperienced Alabama team. I do see Alabama winning probably 31-21 in that type of scoring frame, but I don't see it as a blowout, and it's a shame that everybody just assumes that that's going to be the case, but I guess that's what happens when you win two out of three national championships.
Yeah, just one more question, and then I'll let Seth pretty much dominate the rest of this. The price that they are getting paid, Michigan and Alabama are each making approximately $4.5 million for this game. Do you see that is a problem? I mean, that's basically one-third of a BCS bowl right there to that one individual team, or both of the teams each earning about $4.5 million. Do you think that that's a problem in kind of recruiting, or who's the haves and the have-nots of college football?
I mean, let's face it, there's always been the haves and the have-nots. That's really never going to change. It's in football, it's in every sport, it's in everyday life. That's never going to change. It's just a fact that we have to deal with. I think it's good because it gives these teams incentive to play each other. I mean, let's go back, you know, 5-10 years. Teams were avoiding each other in the quote-unquote preseason and just really, you know, basing all of their national championship hopes on a conference schedule. Now you're seeing, like last year, we had LSU and Oregon. This year, top 10 match of Michigan and Alabama, Boise State going to Michigan State. It's good. It's good for the fans. It's good for your strength of schedule. It's good for your financial status. It's good for everybody when these teams play in the preseason. And, you know, maybe Michigan will fare better. They played Appalachian State and they lost. So maybe if they play Alabama, they're going to have a little bit better luck. So who knows? But I think overall, it's good for college football. It's good for the fans. And it's good for everybody involved.
And that game made Shanti Edwards a second-round pick, if I remember correctly, out of Appalachian State. Speaking of Denard Robinson, when you're looking into this season, there are the obvious Heisman candidates, Matt Barkley from USC, Monty Ball from Wisconsin. Who are the ones that you're seeing a little bit more, that you think, a little bit more off the beaten path?
A guy I like a lot, and he was a Heisman contender last year, could have been a top five pick, Landry Jones from Oklahoma. They had a lot of issues last year, Oklahoma did, with injuries, losing games that they should not have. Nobody's really talking about him this year, and I think that's exactly where Bob Stoops and the Sooners need to be. He's kind of under that radar a little bit, kind of like the New York Giants of college football, where nobody's really talking about him, but they're more than capable of running the table, especially in a weaker Big 12 this year. And rising up, and if that's the case, you know Landry Jones is going to put up big numbers. He did it last year, he did it the year before. If he manages his turnovers a little bit, I think he'll be okay. He plays some defenses that aren't that great, Notre Dame, West Virginia, to name a few. I think he's a guy you need to watch out for, and I also think a guy in the same conference is Geno Smith. Nobody's really talking about this guy at all. West Virginia came over from the Big East. He's a guy that's going to chuck it in Dana Holgorsen's offense. You know, you saw what he did last year. You saw what he did when he was a coordinator at Oklahoma State. He's going to put up big numbers. He's a dual-threat quarterback. He has all the weapons. He's another guy. And one more guy is Aaron Murray out of Georgia. They play the easiest possible schedule you could ever imagine out of the SEC. They could also run the table, and if that's the case, that's going to put him up near the top of Heisman contention.
You actually just took out one of my two surprise Heisman candidates. And if Isaiah Crowell, and we'll get to the SEC in a little bit, hadn't been suspended, they would have been in my national championship game. The other one actually happens to be a third quarterback from the Big 12, perpetually underrated Colin Klein from Kansas State, who somehow lifted that team. Bill Snyder, to me, one of the great coaches of all time, and I am actually, that's not hyperbole. That team was the worst team in college football for decades, and he's built them into a 9-3, 10-2 team. He retires, comes back, and they're back to 9-3, 10-2 again. But, you know, you said that, we'll start with the Big 12. You said that Oklahoma in a down conference this year. Now, the Big 12 was extremely strong last year with Baylor led by RG3, with Oklahoma State, who in my mind deserved a national championship bid. They do bring in West Virginia, the Big East champion, who annihilated Clemson and has an extraordinarily good offense led by Geno Smith and Jorgensen, the ex-offensive coordinator from Oklahoma State. Do you really see a big step down in this conference? And I'm assuming you see Oklahoma as the favorite going in.
Yeah, definitely Oklahoma has to be the favorite given the amount of talent that they have. And I think really given the motivation that I'm sure is built within after the disappointing 2011 season. You look at Texas, there's so much unknown with them. You know, they have the dual quarterbacks with McCoy and Ash. You don't really know what you're going to get from either. You have an experienced defense, but they certainly lack the firepower and offense. They have no identity there. Kansas State, yes, they have Colin Klein. A lot of question marks on the defensive side. And you can say the same about West Virginia as well. TCU lost a lot. Oklahoma State's going to be down. So I think overall, the league is still a good league. It's just not where it was last year. And I don't think there's going to be as many potholes for Oklahoma to try to navigate this year as there was last year. And I really think that's why, I mean, I'm not saying they're going to go undefeated, but I think they have a better chance this year than they did last year.
One more Big 12 question. You had mentioned Texas. And when we talk about coaches on the hot seat, obviously Randy Edsall at Maryland, there's a few others which are pretty blatant. That being said, we've talked about this previously. Mack Brown has possibly the cushiest job in college football. The easiest place to recruit, the best fan base. They have one national title. But the last couple of years have not been good to him. If this team struggles, is there a chance he could be in trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I've kicked this idea around for about a couple of weeks now, and I've come to the conclusion that he shouldn't be, but I can see why he would be. A lot of your success as a college coach depends on your quarterback. And you could say the same for the NFL. They flat out missed on Garrett Gilbert, and I think that was evident when he had to step in and play for McCoy in the championship game against Alabama a couple years ago. You can see that he just didn't have it. He had all the physical tools, but mentally he just wasn't there. And they flat out missed on him, so that, you know, stepped them back about 2 years. Now they're finally getting over that. They're always going to be able to recruit very well. There's no question about that. Get that recruiting in there, get some solid quarterback play, run the ball like they used to. I think they're going to be fine. I don't see another 5-7 season. That defense is going to be pretty dominant this year, again, in a down Big 12. So I don't think he's on the hot seat, and I don't really foresee another disappointing season like last year. And it's a fair question, though, given the fact that they missed a bowl game last year after, you know, being so successful for the last 10 to 12 years. But Mack Brown's a heck of a coach, and that's just the world that we live in, where if you have one or two down seasons, regardless of any past glory that you've had, fans especially are going to put you on the hot seat.
Well, let's talk about the team that is not past glory, and, it's been way, way past glory, and that's my alma mater, Syracuse. Hot seat for Doug Marrone this year?
No, I think he's the right guy for that job. He's put an energy into that team that really hasn't been there for the football program in so long. Obviously, it's a basketball-dominated school. People are excited about it. People are going to the games. he's bringing in. It takes time. You know what I mean? They were really at the bottom of the Big East, and really, you could argue at the bottom of D1 football that it takes time. It takes time to get talent in there. It takes time to get to instill your type of program that you need to be done. And I don't think there's quite the expectations or quite the demand on Doug Marrone that there is not. And I think it would be fair to hold him.
As Syracuse fans, I think we have an expectation of winning maybe 2 games this year, one of which will not be at the Meadowlands against USC, which is coming up in a week and a half.
But it'll be a damn good tailgate, and that's all that really matters. Well, we'll jump over to the Big East. The Big East is now, with West Virginia gone, so weak. I mean, I'm assuming you're looking at Louisville as probably the favorite going in. Do you agree?
They have the most experienced team. They have the best coach. They probably have the best quarterback. I guess maybe you can make an argument for B.J. Daniels out of South Florida, but I feel like we've been waiting for 4 or 5 years for him to reach the level that he needs to be in that program, too, in the same regard. But Teddy Bridgewater, by far the best quarterback in the conference. They're going to have a fairly solid defense. Their schedule is favorable, and they should. I think Rutgers will probably give them a little bit of run for their money. And it seems like every year there might be a clear-cut winner, but the Big East, for some reason, everybody ends up 4-3 and 5-2 somehow. There's like an 8-way tie for the top. But I just see Louisville by a notch over Rutgers. They have the best personnel and the best coach, and that usually is what gets the job done for you.
Well, the question will be another year, because if I remember, Louisville is mostly underclass. So 2013-14, you could be looking at a really strong team, although I just don't think Charlie Strong is going to be there because I think someone else, a bigger team, is going to swallow him up.
Yes.
Moving a little bit further south, we've had a pretty mediocre conference in the ACC for the last, well, even since the expansion 2 decades ago. Is this the year with Virginia Tech, with Logan Thomas, and Florida State's defense, and Clemson's offense with Sammy Watkins and Taj Boyd, are we looking at a legitimate national contender here?
It's a great question. I think that's a question everybody's been asking for the last 10 years about Virginia Tech, about Florida State. I mean, if there's going to be a year for Florida State to do it, it's this year. That defense is going to be absolutely dominant. Emmanuel, he's a senior. They have all the talent that you could ever want. They have a favorable schedule, except for the fact that they have to travel to Virginia Tech. Now, obviously, that game is going to be a huge dictator as to where each team stands in the national picture, as well as the ACC picture. But there's no question that both teams can finish undefeated. There's no question. I just don't know. I can't put any stock in Virginia Tech, and I can't put any stock in Florida. We've seen what Virginia Tech historically has done. They'll go out, they'll lose their first game, lose their second game, and then rattle off 10 in a row, and then somehow always find themselves in the argument at 11-1, but they never had the strength of schedule, and this year is going to be the same way. And as for Florida State, I just don't see how they can win at Virginia Tech in that environment. That doesn't mean they won't beat them in the ACC championship, so I think you could see a scenario where both teams are 11-1, maybe one's 11-1, the other's 10-2, but I don't see a national championship contender coming out of the ACC, and not to disregard Clemson or slight them at all, but I think they're probably a year or two away, especially on the defensive side of the ball, where they just really can't compete at the national level yet.
Although having brought in Brent Venable, the defensive coordinator from Oklahoma, will help. Moving further south to the SEC, we've gone the last 6 years, I believe we've had 5 SEC champions. The champion has come out of the SEC 5 times, 2 from Alabama, LSU, and Auburn, of course. Are we looking at a 6 out of 7 here?
Oh, man, you really put me on the spot with that. I mean, it's really hard to envision a scenario where the winner of the SEC West doesn't play for the national title. It's really hard to just – I don't think there is a possible. One of those teams is probably going to be undefeated. And I kind of go against the grain here and think that it's probably going to be LSU. I don't really think the loss of Matthew hurts them a ton. Maybe in the kick game it does. They lose that explosive play capability there. But I think it's a rallying point. You know, teams look for that during the season. They look for a reason to unite. Obviously, the national championship is the preeminent goal, but they look for a reason to come together, fight for a goal. They're going to do this for him. There's no question about it. And they get Alabama in Baton Rouge. That's huge. You're not going to go in to LSU and win a game at night. There's just not a chance. So that's why I like LSU coming out of the West and more than likely playing for the national championship unless they stumble along the way. I don't really see any other teams in that division. I'm not as high on Arkansas as a lot of other people are.
That was the game I was gonna touch on. With obviously the Bobby Petrino debacle, you still have a top quarterback in Tyler Wilson, the running back Nive Davis coming back from surgery. You don't see them as a top five team, or is it a potential? I don't want to say dark horse, but a potential championship caliber.
No, they just don't have the talent that LSU and Alabama does. You know what I mean? They're not recruiting at the same level as the top programs, even in their conference, let alone the nation. They have a great quarterback, but I hate to say it, but that's about it. And we got force-fed by the media last year about how they were a contender and this and that, and then they got blown out by LSU, and that's it. That's the end of it for me. If you can't compete on that stage with that team that they had last year, there's no way they're going to compete this year, and I don't see them as a threat. I see them as maybe 8-4, 9-3. They're definitely going to take it down a notch, and I don't think they're going to live up to the expectations that they had coming into this year.
We got two more conferences to hit on. Number one, the Big Ten, or the Big Ten Plus One, or the Big 11, or whatever the heck it's called. I still can't get it straight, actually, after all these years. It's stacked. You have Wisconsin, led by Maryland transfer Danny O'Brien and Monty Ball. You have Michigan State with that great defense, although they lose Kirk Cousins. You have Michigan with Denard Robinson, as we've discussed. You have Ohio State, although not bowl eligible, stacked and ready with Urban Meyer coming back after his one-year retirement. How do you see the conference playing out?
Obviously, Wisconsin is going to represent the leaders' division in the Big Ten Championship, with Ohio State being on probation and not able to compete. It's ultimately a three-horse race in the legends with Michigan State, Michigan, and Nebraska. Nobody's really talking about Nebraska. Their defense is going to be fantastic. Taylor Martinez, another year under his belt. The question with him, as it has always been, is can he pass the ball? And I think you could say the same thing about Denard Robinson. He lost his best receiver in Junior Hemingway, so he doesn't have that guy that can go up and get the ball. And Denard Robinson likes to throw jump balls, and he makes far too many mistakes to, A, be considered for the Heisman, and, B, lead his team to a Big Ten championship. With that said, Michigan State has to be the favorite in the legends and, set up a rematch with Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is one of those dark horse teams. Their season, in my opinion, really comes down to one game, and that's against Nebraska. They're going to be Michigan State at home. And if they can get past Nebraska at Nebraska, I see them being 12-0 going into a Big Ten championship rematch with Michigan State with a potential national championship berth on the line.
Okay. We got one more big conference to go. I know you can't stay on. I know you'd like to talk about this for hours, but maybe we'll try and do a podcast early in the season. You go to the Pac-10 the last couple of years. It's been the Andrew Luck show. Stanford is gone, although not forgotten. You should still be strong. But we are really looking at a two-team race here, aren't we?
No question about it. I think the survivor out of this conference will probably end up playing for the national championship. To me, it's really hard, as talented as USC is, and the fact that they may get to play this game twice at home against Oregon, I just don't see how they beat Oregon twice. Oregon's defense this year is going to be a lot better than it has been in previous years, and I'm not really sold on USC's defense. Their offense, of course, is going to be, very prolific. Barkley, the two receivers, Silas Red, obviously, no question about that. To me, it comes down to the Oregon experience, where they've been there before, maybe not at the quarterback position, maybe not at the running back position, but on the defensive side of the ball, they've been there. And they have a chip on their shoulder after last year. USC came into Eugene, beat them after Maldonado missed that last-second field goal. So there's that motivation, that edge, that chip on their shoulder that, you know what, we don't like USC. We're going to go into L.A. We're going to beat them. We're going to be 12-0. We're going to play for the national championship. No questions asked. Not going to leave it up to voters, take it right out of their hands, and claim the Pac-12 championship and a potential national championship.
I know you got to go, so we're going to end on two questions. Number one,
sure.
Who are the Heisman candidates going to New York?
Oh, man, you put me on the spot. I think Barkley, it's a foregone conclusion that he's going to be one. Monte Ball, obviously, he was there last year. I do see Geno Smith, especially if West Virginia can somehow manage to get to 9-3, 10-2. I'm going to go Landry Jones as four. And, honestly, a fifth, potentially DeAnthony Thomas out of Oregon. He's probably the fastest person that I've ever seen run. I don't think, to me, he's their game breaker. He is their LaMichael James. He's going to get the ball as much as anybody on any team in the nation. He's one of my few dark horses that can get there, and especially if Oregon's 12-0, there's no doubt in my mind that he can make it to New York City.
Okay, I'm going to throw mine out there as well. Barkley, I agree, is a foregone conclusion. I don't think Monty Ball will be there. I think with James White and Melvin Gordon, you're going to have a lot of there's going to be a lot of spread, a little bit more than last year. Although Monty obviously had 37, God knows how many run, how many touchdowns, 38,
39.
Ridiculous number.
39.
Thank you. There you go. Aaron Murray, I will take. I still think he is a great player, and I think he could. That team still can surprise. Although without Crowell, I think they're in trouble. I shouldn't say in trouble. I don't know if a championship is in the works. Geno Smith agreed. I think that's three. The name I'm going to throw out there, if he's healthy, that's a big if, is Marcus Lattimore, the running back from South Carolina.
Absolutely.
And who I think is an absolute stud. And I'll put Denard Robinson as my fifth. National chip. And if we'll finish this off. I'm sorry, Sean, do you want to throw your five out there, or are you content listening?
I will go with you, but I do have one question for our expert. If you had to give a score for the Syracuse-USC game, what would it be? I am thinking my own score is 38-13.
Which team?
Oh, well, nobody goes into upstate New York and just rolls over Syracuse until USC does it a week and a half from now.
No, this is in the Meadowlands. This is in the Meadowlands. This is not in the Carrington.
That's true. I'm going to go, and you might want to close your ears, I'm going to go 52-10. I'm sorry. It's not even going to be close. They're going to have a point to prove all season. This game's on the national stage. Syracuse can't match up athletically, and I don't know. I'm sorry.
If I take it from you, number one, take the over, and number two, take the spread.
That would be the road.
I don't even know what the spread is, but it's not 40.
I'm gonna have it somewhere in between. And Mike, if you feel like driving up a few hours to the Meadowlands, Sean and I will be tailgating probably considering what this game is gonna be to Syracuse fans for probably a long time.
Long time. I may have to take you up on that offer.
Groupon has great seats.
I'm gonna go somewhere in between 45-10. Your national championship game, I should say.
My national championship game, I know I talked up Oregon, I talked up USC. I'm going to go Oklahoma, and I'm going to go LSU. I think the Big 12 is down. I think Oklahoma takes advantage of that with a veteran quarterback and prolific weapons on the offensive side. And I think LSU, they peaked a year early. That wasn't the team that was supposed to contend. This year's team, even without Tyrann Mathieu, it's the team that was supposed to contend. So I have Oklahoma versus LSU, and I have LSU winning the national championship.
Okay, I'm going to go a little bit off the beaten path here. I'm going to say there will be no SEC team in the national championship game. I have Oregon, Wisconsin, and led by my beloved ex-Maryland quarterback, Daniel Bryan, I'm taking the Wisconsin Badgers to win the national championship. Mike,
all right. Now, I actually do have a prediction for the national championship game.
Okay, please.
I am totally off the beaten path, and I'm going for the team that I actually want to see rather than the ones I probably will say. I will have USC beating Virginia Tech in the national championship game.
That's a very solid prediction. I mean, this is the year of the Virginia Tech with Logan Thomas and that running game and that defense. Get Florida State at home. If there's a year for it, it's going to be this year. So that's not a bad prediction at all.
Okay, Mike, everybody listening, watch for Mike's articles and probably some weekly picks where Mike and I will be going back and forth on backsportspage.com. Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Have a good one.
Right. Well, that was we had our college expert, considering I took a back seat and I know nothing about the sport. You can now come back in January and say I was right when USC beats Virginia Tech in the national championship, and you can say hell to all those experts that know nothing. No, that will not
happen. Sean Palmer, ladies and gentlemen.
That will not happen. I understand. But anyway, so that college football is definitely coming full circle this week. I mean, we have Penn State finally getting back into the swing of things on the football field more than anything else. Their opening day is this weekend, and it's nice for them to get back to football.
It has obviously been a horrendous year off the field. Tyrann Mathieu, the Penn State. At least we see an end in sight to the BCS. we go from there. And now we're back to football. And speaking of football, let's go to the professional kind where Mr. Palmer is as big an expert as anybody. And I'm going to start with a team we don't talk about very often. Seattle Seahawks.
No.
No, that's a team that nobody wants to talk about. And if anyone, I should say, we actually haven't done this. If anyone wants to call in to talk a little football or anything else, 760-283-0846. The Seattle Seahawks signed Matt Flynn to a 3-year, $24 million contract and are starting the fifth rookie quarterback.
Yep.
Russell Wilson, who's been sensational in preseason, but this is surprising. How do you see this working? Is this the right move? Do you see them as any threat to San Francisco in the AFC West?
Well, here's the thing. It was said around draft time that if Russell Wilson was 3 inches taller, he would have been a top 10 pick. The only reason that Russell Wilson went in the third round is because he was under 6 feet tall. He's 5'11 and a half. Now, me being 5'8 and a half, that's pretty tall, 5'11 and a half. But by NFL standards for quarterbacks, you want to be over 6 feet. I don't know, a guy named Drew Brees is under 6 feet, but hell, I mean, really, what? You got to be over 6 feet to play an NFL quarterback. And the reasoning that they say you have to be over 6 feet is to be able to see over the offensive linemen. But if you find your spots, if you find your passageways, I know there's a word that I'm missing, that between the tackles, if you find the throwing lanes, that's what I was looking for. If you find the throwing lanes and you don't get balls batted down, you could be 4'5". If you got a clear path to the wide receiver. Matt Flynn did sign a 3-year, $21 million contract. He got his signing bonus of $6 million. His salary for this year will be approximately $4 million. If you look around the NFL, backup quarterbacks are making approximately $4 million, especially those named Kyle Orton or Jason Cannon. So the fact that Matt Flynn is now the backup quarterback, as far as salary is concerned, not a big deal. If Russell Wilson is the best guy for the job, if I'm the Seattle Seahawks, I definitely go with him. If you look at the rosters right now, there are 14 to 16 teams that are going to start quarterbacks under the age of 26. That's incredible for the NFL. That means that they're not doing the Steve McNair, I'm going to let guys sit for 3 years anymore. You draft quarterbacks, you put them in the game. Let's see how they play. I think this is the right move. Do they challenge San Francisco? San Francisco is all about Alex Smith this year. Again, speaking of which, it's all about Alex Smith.
I'm sorry,
is it
Monday Night Football and I missed it?
No, it's draft time in 18 minutes. But the work draft.
This is one of Sean's 11 fantasy drafts this year. I can only handle two. How many do you have? Six?
Yeah, six. And next week is yours and mine. Next Monday night.
Yeah,
Monday night. 7 o'clock.
Yeah, this is our week. We have Monday, we have our draft. Tuesday, we have our show. Wednesday, we have Giants Cowboys. Woo!
And Thursday, we have recovery.
And then Saturday, we have Syracuse USA.
It's a nice football week.
It is a big football week. The other big news, Terrell Owens in Seattle. Terrell Owens being cut in favor of Braylon Edwards, a sentence you never really thought you would hear. Terrell is 37. He's in incredible shape, but his hands, which have never been the best, seem to have really started to fall. Is he going to get another shot?
I don't think so. I think the most incredible thing that I took out of that is that Braylon Edwards is only 29 years old. Braylon Edwards seems to have been around forever.
That is the oldest 29-year-old man I've ever... Greg Oden is the oldest-looking 20... Well, he's 25. Oh, 23. The oldest-looking 23- or 24-year-old man. But Braylon Edwards feels like he's been around for 15 years.
Doesn't he? And he's only 29 years old. I was surprised. I was shocked.
Well, if you had told me before this year... that of the four quarter of Randy Moss, Plaxico Burress, Chad Johnson, and T.O., that the only person with a team going into the regular season would be Randy Moss?
Randy Moss. And he'd be on the 49ers. And he'd be on the 49ers with Jim Harbaugh.
But supposedly he's been exemplary. It's going to be curious to see how he'll adapt.
He's on my fantasy league. I'm waiting for him.
We probably gave away too many fantasy for our fantasy leagues. We actually partner in the league on Monday because it's a pretty big league. So we probably shouldn't give away too many secrets to begin with.
We'll talk about it on Tuesday, how our draft went. I think the bigger transactional move was that the Ravens decided to cut their kicker yesterday. And I say this because Billy Kondo has been one of the best kickers in the NFL for the last 3 years. So, and yes, he missed a 30-yard chip shot that basically ruined the Ravens season last year. But they're going with a rookie to kick in what should be probably one of the NFL's, preseason favorites for the Super Bowl. That's a lot of pressure to put on a kicker.
Well, the other reason supposedly given was while Cundiff under 50 has been fantastic, the last 2 years he's 1 for 7 over 50 yards. Cundiff will be picked up by another team. Well, it's not like he's playing in Pittsburgh or playing in Chicago. Oh, has he been picked up already?
He went down the pike. He went down the
95. He went to Washington.
He did. Gano is Gano.
I was going to say Gano is gone.
I really just did do that, didn't I?
Yes, he did. Speaking of gone, we're still searching for the New York Jets offense. I guess you can't even say it's gone because it just hasn't been there. 30 possessions, no touchdowns?
They found some white substance in the locker room, and it turned out to be the goal line.
But yeah,
exactly.
So, are you worried? As a diehard Jets fan, how concerned are you?
We're going to go 7-9. I'm giving up my prediction for next week, but we're going to go 7-9. We're not going to make the playoffs. We made a trade today and got Jason Smith for Wayne Hunter. Thank God we got rid of Hunter. But we're going to go 7-9, not make the playoffs. The team is just not good. The defense is excellent, but it's not a top five defense. It's not a top five of all time defense. We're not going to shut. And I say we and collectively, we are not going to shut down every team to 10 points or less. And if we don't do that, we are not going to win games.
Oh, you're a great pass defense. I'm not sure how great a running defense you are, but. Yeah, I'm not. We'll talk about that next week when we do our NFL preview, and that should be a doozy. I guess the other big news, the Dez Bryant, the Bryant rules, for lack of a better term, have to be in by 12. No strip clubs, no drinking. You're chauffeured everywhere. You're a professional. Why do we need to do this? Why should we have to do this?
Wait, why not? I don't have a problem. You really have a problem with this?
No, I think it's pathetic.
Oh, agreed. But at the end of the day, you and I, every time a player is arrested for drunk driving, what's the first thing we say?
Call a cab. Why didn't the genius call a cab?
Right, or call a limo, right? Because he can have a limo. Okay. Every time we wind up that a person is in a strip club and he gets arrested for assault, what do we say? Where was the bouncer? Where was the bodyguard, right? That's basically what we say. Or why was he even there, right? Basically, these guys can afford enough to bring a stripper to the hotel. Why do you need to be in a strip club? Not to go down that road, but really, don't they? So each of these rules is things that we've all talked about before in relation to the players, but only after it happened. They're just taking a preemptive strike and doing it before. I don't have a problem with this.
Do you see racial overtones with it?
Absolutely not. From what I understand and from what reports I have read, Dez Bryant's people asked for this. They asked for this help. And you know what? It takes a lot to ask for it.
Well, it also takes a lot to shove your mama. But
well,
I guess that's a whole other
true.
Story.
That's another story. People make mistakes. They pay the price. This may be the price, but at the same time, you know what? I don't have a problem with this. This is what... Okay, so you got a limo to and from practice. All right. Most athletes do have that. You have to be in before midnight. Well, generally most trouble for NFL players occurs after midnight. That's not a problem. You can't go to the strip club. Well, we've learned in the past that most players that go to strip clubs end up arrested. I don't have a problem with all this. This is good stuff. Why is this a bad thing? Is it baby? So?
No. It's not a bad thing. I think it's actually the right move. I find it pathetic that it's necessary. I don't find it pathetic that it's occurring. I'm surprised that Bryant is paying for it, although I kind of wonder if that's one of those where Jerry Jones is just because of salary cap ramifications, unless I'm mistaken.
Yep.
I find that a bit weird. But I'm assuming there'll be something under the table, which wouldn't surprise me. Not that we'll ever find that out, of course.
Of course not.
But, it's just interesting. It does show some version of maturity that he did it. I just find it a sad reflection on society that it was necessary.
This is the NFL. I mean, let's call it what it is. This is not society. I mean, really. The NFL is not society. The NFL is a different world than we live in, than normal people live in. So I don't really see this as all of a problem. I think this is actually something that should be done on more levels. And if people realized that they had these problems, I don't have a problem with this whatsoever. I think this is one of the best things that the Cowboys could have done. They're protecting their investment. What makes this any different than anybody else protecting theirs?
Fair enough. Other NFL news. Chris Cooley's cut.
Yeah.
It kind of disappoints me. He had such a hot wife. Still does, I
assume. He also tweeted the first X-rated picture.
He did? And
he tweeted his playbook, but he was naked when he tweeted it, so a little bit of his manhood was in the picture.
Understood. Cooley is Cooley. I've never been a Redskin fan. I'm a Giant fan who lived in D.C. for 10 years, so actually watching Washington, this was in a lot of ways before the real evolution of sports bars and fantasy football and all this. So I got stuck watching a lot of Redskin games, and it was awful. I am not a Redskin fan, never will be. I can tell you stories about listening to Redskin fans that I could write a book about. But I will say I always enjoyed...
Wow, his wife really is hot.
Yeah. She was actually, if I remember correctly, she was a Redskins cheerleader, and she got fired because she started dating him. And then they got married because you weren't allowed to date within. And Cooley, I always thought was a fun. He was a good player. He played the game right. I hope he gets picked up somewhere else. Also, I guess Mike, where do you think we're seeing Maurice Jones-Drew? Does he come back for Game One?
Yeah. Oh, for Game One. Well, I think he has to. There's no leverage here. I mean, absolutely no leverage. I mean, he is demanding. He got a new contract 2 years ago. He led the league in rushing last year, so he thinks that he deserves another new contract. And Rashard Jennings has had a great preseason for the Jaguars. If you're looking for a sleeper in fantasy, Rashard Jennings, definitely look him up, along with Alfred Morris this week, for those that are going into their drafts this weekend. But I think that he's got nothing there. He's really got nothing. He's got no leverage, so why not? So I think he's got to come back. I wouldn't take him in my draft, but I got the sixth pick tonight, and he's ranked number fifth, so I might have to.
But he's ranked number fifth?
He's ranked fifth overall.
Well, I prefer that he's ranked number fifth. It's another reflection on the education at Syracuse.
He's ranked fifth overall, number five.
Yeah, I have two big drafts. One is on Thursday night. I'm number eight, and I have no idea what I'm going to do with it, to be honest. And then I have the one with you, which is option, and which we will be better this year. But we will not be
spending $71 on Aaron Rodgers.
No, we will not. Since you have a draft, in 4 minutes. So I guess it starts at 8 o'clock. You want to start the close up?
Sure, I'll start the close up. Jim Irsay, the new George Steinbrenner. Now, George Steinbrenner, I saw a special today on the 1977 Yankees and when they got Reggie Jackson, and how Reggie became the stir that. The straw that stirred the drink, which one of the greatest lines ever in sports, and also caused the biggest mutiny of all time in the Yankee locker room. But the only reason that he was there was because George wanted him. Jim Irsay is a different type of owner. He's the only owner that tweets nonstop, and he tweets about everything. And he tweeted about a trade that was going to happen for the Colts. He didn't tweet the names, he didn't tweet the positions or whatnot, he just tweeted a trade was going to occur. I love these owners. I love the Jim Irsays. I love the Mark Cubans. I love the Magic Johnsons, the guys that will step foot, take the good, but also take the bad. And there is a lot of bad that goes along with owning a team. You also have to take a whole lot of criticism.
Most importantly, did he take them all, and did he end up with the facts of life?
Funny.
Thank you.
But at the same time, he takes the good, he takes the bad, he takes them all, and then,
I thought it was pretty good, actually.
It was. And then you have the Mets ownership. And I go from one extreme to the other, because, man, can Fred Wilpon please sell this team? The Mets have been downhill since a month and a half ago, since the All-Star break. They're not re-signing their players. They're holding David Wright out to dry. And if you want to listen to something funny, and I don't like Mike Francesa whatsoever, I do not like listening to him. YouTube, Mike Francesa rant about the Mets this week. 10 minutes, blasting ownership. Mike Francesa, well done, because quite frankly, you spoke the word that every Mets fan wanted to hear. Mr. Kamen.
Well, I actually realized that for the second week in a row, we've forgotten to discuss the question of the day. So I know you have your draft. Do you want me to go through mine?
Sure. I can listen.
Okay.
I can talk. I'm still on. Go.
Okay. So the question of the day was your favorite college football moment. And so we have a few. I have actually three, but we have a few here. Brian from New York. Flutie with no time on the clock to beat Miami. I was 7 years old, but remember it like it was yesterday. The Doug Flutie to Gerald Fallon catch, 47-45. Pretty amazing game in 1984 where Flutie pretty much clinched a Heisman in the beginning of November. You remember it?
I do.
Toby from Maryland. One of the most... The LeVar leap, the most athletic and instinctual play I've ever seen live. And this was actually Penn State LeVar Arrington, who was a number two pick by the Redskins, hurdling an offensive lineman to tackle an Illinois player on 4th-and-1. You remember that? He also did this.
Absolutely.
He actually also did this for a field goal. He did this as well.
Yeah.
One of our favorites, David from Washington. What a surprise. The catch. See you at Michigan. The Cordell Stewart to Michael Westbrook. In, I want to say, 1994, I believe, because I think it was my freshman year at Maryland, and I saw it. David actually played Division III at Colorado College. Mike from New Jersey, the California Bears kick return with 4 seconds left to beat Stanford, the most ridiculous play ever, pretty much, the blast in the past, 1980. Good call, Mike. Asa, whose radio show Foul Territory will be on Thursday night. Vince Young's 2005 Rose Bowl performance against USC, so sad to see him released again. He was full and far, but on that day, he was the best football player on earth. and the vaunted Trojan D-bags fell before him like so many autumn leaves. Wow, what a poet. And actually, and this is what I love, is when you come up with the obscure ones. Jordan from California. Can't tell where he went to college after this, I'm sure. 1998, Ortega Jenkins, Arizona Wildcats quarterback, does a front flip into the end zone to win the game at Washington with 7 seconds left. Find the video. It is actually pretty awesome. I want to thank you guys for submitting. Do you have any or no?
I don't. I only have my own. What is yours?
I have three of them, so I'll go with you. I'll go with you first. So why don't you do yours first?
Okay, I have two of them. Number one is Donovan McNabb rolling right, finding Steve Brominski in the corner of the end zone to offset the Virginia Tech Hokies, which I was in the marching band, obviously, in Syracuse and jumping up and down and almost having a heart attack. That's number one. Number two is the first college football game I ever saw live. Syracuse lost to Oklahoma in overtime on a 49-yard field goal with me standing on the field waiting to do the what would have been a show between overtime and me just going, are you kidding me? 49 yards, first game, we lose.
Okay, I'm going to give – I have three of them. Number three is actually the greatest day of football I've ever seen. I had to look up the date, but I remembered the games. October 15th, 2005. There was a bunch of games, but there were three that I remember being remarkable. One was Louisville, West Virginia, which I believe went six overtimes. In West Virginia with Steve Slayton scoring six touchdowns, winning 46-44. Number two, you had undefeated Penn State against Michigan, and Michigan scoring in the last play of the game to beat Penn State and to pretty much knock them out of the national championship. On a pass to Mario Manningham. And the third game, which I remember from that day, was actually the Bush push. When Matt Miner, again, probably the best game that Charlie Weiss ever coached at Notre Dame, but they lost. USC comes back and does a 2-minute fourth and nine throw from Matt Miner to Dwayne Jarrett. Miner scores on a disputed fourth down touchdown run, 34-31. Greatest day of football I've ever seen, actually. Number two, yes, I had to throw a Maryland highlight in. Scott McBrien Gary, scoring a touchdown in the last minute of the game to give Maryland the ACC championship for the only time in their history since I was a student. That was 2002. The cornerstone jumped so high that my head almost hit the ceiling fan. But the greatest thing I've ever seen in college football, and it's probably one of the three or four greatest things I've ever seen in sports, Boise State, Oklahoma, the hook and ladder to put the game into overtime. Boise State, of course, up 21-0. Oklahoma scored, or up 28-0. Oklahoma scores four touchdowns, ties it, has an interception return off of Jared Zablanski, goes up 35-28. Boise State, 4th-19, does the, the hook and ladder to put the game in overtime. Adrian Peterson scores a touchdown. Boise State goes halfback option, 4th-and-goal, touchdown, and then the Statue of Liberty for the two-point conversion, and then Ian Johnson proposing on the run-in. Greatest thing I've ever seen. Thanks to Mike Pizeski for coming in. You'll be able to see his stuff on backsportspage.com. I'm going to give my final shout-out, or I have two quick shout-outs. Number one to my boy Nabate Isles, who at long last, he's been on the show a couple times before, and he's hosted it with me before Sean became the permanent co-host. He's just gotten a job at ESPN New York working, actually doing pregame for the Jets in their programming area. I'm really happy for him. Number two, my props out, and this is going to sound strange, to Lance Armstrong. After 10 years of fighting, and it's been ironic. My guy used to be my best friend, a guy named Jeff Scheck, used to always say, you're not American because you don't believe Lance Armstrong. You believe Lance Armstrong is guilty. And I would say, absolutely, because I believe every cyclist is guilty. And it was much funnier coming from him because he was actually one of the funniest people I've ever met. He ends up, Lance Armstrong finally decides this week he's had enough. And he's not going to fight anymore. He's going to say, fine, whatever, take the seven Tour de France's away. The reality is, guess what, USADA, no one cares. what are you going to really remember about Lance Armstrong? And yes, did he win the seven Tour de France? Are you going to forget that he won? It's like Reggie Bush winning the Heisman. You may take it away. He still won it. I'm sure he still has copies, has a copy of the Heisman somewhere. You spent so much time and effort on this. Nobody cares. Look what Lance Armstrong did. He recovers from testicular cancer, wins a couple more Tour de France. He raises $475 million in charity. Really. This is what I will remember Lance Armstrong for. Not that he supposedly did this and that. Do I think he was guilty? Probably. Do I care? No. When you raise $475 million for charity, guess what? That takes priority over whatever the heck, whatever drugs he was on, which, of course, still was never proven. So best of luck to you, Lance Armstrong. I wish you the best, and your charitable endeavors more than make up for anyone has ever done in that regard. And that's pretty much all I have to say. Next week's the NFL preview. Sean is probably right now looking to take Maurice Jones-Drew, number 5th overall. For Sean Palmer, Seth Kamens, backsportspage.com.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. With the 6th pick in the draft, I took LeSean McCoy.
He went to number 5. Jeez. Even better. Hope I get him at 6 next week. Check out our NFL preview next week. It should be good. Have a good night, everybody.
Night.